So our first case today is the United States v. Rodney Ashe, 24-1027. Counsel? Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Rahul Sharma. I'm an assistant federal public defender, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Ashe. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. Sure. Your Honors, to ensure the integrity of the sentencing process, sentencing enhancements must be found by a preponderance of the evidence. Time and again, this court has said that the preponderance standard is not toothless, and that it may only be satisfied with reliable, specific evidence.
Were you involved in the sentencing hearing itself?
No, Your Honor, I was not.
I mean, obviously something went awry because prosecutors and the defense had agreed that this did not apply, and yet you can see why somebody, you know, sitting, you know, what the first impression would be that, are you kidding me? It has to apply here, that he had this gun in the trunk. There's nobody else, supposedly, that could got into the trunk until many months later. What was the response at the sentencing?
Well, Your Honor, the response of the government was, well, it's his car, but we don't know who else had access to the trunk. And the judge rejected that possibility and said, okay, well, does the defense want to say anything? I've already, you know, rejected what the government said. So we think that that was clear error here. We think that the district court did make several factual findings, which we don't dispute. What we dispute is that those findings were sufficient to conclude that Mr. Ashe knew about the duffel bag and containing the gun found in the trunk of his car
Was there any evidence of record that he knew the gun was in the car?
No, Your Honor. There was no incriminating statement. There was no incriminating observation by police, such as that he had sole access to the car or that he had ever possessed a similar duffel bag or gun before. Frequently, police are able to find, social media in showing similar guns or whatever. And
error, though, is a tough standard, right, for us to, you know, to say that a court committed clear error and making factual determinations. Help me understand how we get there.
Your Honor, I think that this court's precedent in U.S. v. Chicharello from 2002 is very instructive here. The court in that case found that the evidence was at least in equipoise, and therefore that the preponderance standard hadn't been met. The clear error standard is a tough standard, Your Honor, but I think that here the preponderance standard plainly wasn't met, as the government, I think, recognized below. There was no incriminating statement showing that he had knowledge of the gun. There was no incriminating observation. There was no incriminating physical evidence, such as ID cards in the bag or DNA on the gun or fingerprints on the gun, nothing of the sort. And so given the lack...
It's a chain of custody then issue. And what are the things that would have to be proven as elements of showing that there was a chain of custody from him to the gun?
Right, Your Honor. So I think for the possibility that a tow yard employee or someone had, tampered with the car, there would have to be evidence stronger than a representative of the tow yard.
What would the elements be? Isn't one of them that he had to know of the gun's existence?
Yes,
and then intend to exercise dominion and control?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, and what evidence was there of those items?
We don't believe that there was evidence of those items, Your Honor. I mean, the district court essentially made four factual findings. One, that Mr. Ashe owned and was driving the car. Two,
you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Four factual findings, which we don't dispute. One, that he owned and was driving the car. Two, that he had a handgun on his person, a 9mm handgun on his person. Three, that he had prior convictions for possessing handguns. And four, that a tow yard employee 7 months after the arrest found a vastly different gun, an AK-style rifle, in a duffel bag in the trunk of the car in the tow yard.
The district court leaned on the fact that he had these priors for firearms in reaching his conclusion. How much should he have, do you think he is appropriate in doing so?
So I don't think that, I'm not going to say that in no case should prior convictions for having firearms, I'm not going to say that it's not the least bit probative. I think that it can be probative of whether someone possessed other firearms, as in U.S. v. Irvin, which the government cites as a case. I mean, I think in Irvin, it's just one of about five factors in determining that the defendant in that case possessed other firearms. But I do think that what's important here is that there was no, you know, the government very helpfully in its brief at pages 34 and 35 shows the gun that was possessed here on Mr. Ash, and that the style of gun that he had previously been convicted of possessing, and the gun that was found in the trunk. And the gun that was found in the trunk, as this court can see, is vastly different than any gun that Mr. Ash had previously been convicted of possessing. I think that the problem here is we don't know who else had access to the car before. I don't think that there's just a chain of custody problem here. I think as the government recognized, I'm sorry.
That's okay. You know. So you are taking me to somewhere where I will be honest, I have questions, which is do we know anything about what happens when the gun is found? Is there an investigation? Who is the employee? What do we know about what happened, the circumstances surrounding the finding of the gun, all the way to, I guess, the gun getting to the police station? What do we know about that?
Very little, Your Honor. I mean, I think that all we know is that a tow yard employee says that they found the gun in the trunk. And we don't know how many tow yard employees there were. We don't know what sort of security background checks there are for tow yard employees. We don't know if one of the tow yard employees, if there are several tow yard employees, says, I don't like storing illegal guns at my home. I store them elsewhere. I have access to these cars. I can store my illegal guns in the cars. I think that that is just one of many issues here. And I think that Your Honor is correct to have questions. I mean, I think that the district court had a lot of questions, and the district court was like, why wasn't this tested? Why don't I have any questioning of him as
in lieu of all these hypotheticals and what ifs, would it make sense to remand this for a more robust evidentiary hearing?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that would make sense. I believe that what makes most sense is to reverse.
Why doesn't that make sense?
Okay. Well, this court has held, you know, as far back as U.S. v. Dickler, 64 F3rd 818, Third Circuit, 1995, that where the government has the burden of production and persuasion, as it does on issues like enhancement of the offense level, its case should ordinarily have to stand or fall on the record it makes the first time around. It should not normally be afforded a second bite at the apple, unquote. To overcome that ordinary rule on remand, the government must tender a persuasive reason why fairness requires providing the government with an additional opportunity to present evidence on remand. Here, there's no possibility of the government tendering such a reason because the party's plea agreement stipulates that the offense level should be 14, not 20. And so I think this case is simultaneously a very unusual case where the district court not only, you know, rejected the party's agreement, but I think had lots of questions as, you know, it it expressed to the parties, as it expressed to the government, and I think, you know, took those questions and assumed that one of those questions would be answered in the affirmative. It asked why there wasn't DNA or fingerprint evidence collected, and it, I think, assumed that if it had been collected, Mr. Ash would have found Mr. Ash's on it. I think it had questions about why he wasn't questioned about it, and it assumed, the court assumed, that there would have been an incriminating statement. And based on these assumptions, and I think pretty speculative assumptions, it doubled Mr. Ash's guidelines range. It effectively doubled it from 15 to 21 to 30 to 37. I think that this is an unusual case, and so, you know, I don't think there's a floodgates problem. I do think at the same time that this is a very good opportunity for this court to reaffirm, as it did in Chicharello, that, you know, over 20 years ago, as it did in Chicharello, that the preponderance standard isn't toothless and that it does require reliable, specific evidence of wrongdoing in order to potentially double, or with other enhancements, even triple or multiply by an order of magnitude other people's, other defendants' sentencing enhancements.
How is this case different from our Kennedy case about 10 years ago? Now, I realize it's an NPO, but it was our court finding that this enhancement does apply with respect to a gun that was found later in a secret compartment. So how is this really any different? Other than it was in a trunk and not necessarily a secret compartment.
Well, as I understand it, Your Honor, in Kennedy there was, I apologize, I'm not able to talk about the specifics of Kennedy except for the fact that, there was a similar finding, but I don't know whether there was other evidence.
Well, there was. Kennedy. I mean, there was a stamp that tied the gun to the defendant.
Okay.
And fingerprint evidence. And
okay.
I believe the car was in the marshal's custody the entire time.
Well, there you have it. I apologize that I'm not prepared to talk about that case, but given those pieces of corroborating evidence, I do think that case is readily distinguishable. Thank you, Your Honors.
See you on the bottom. Good morning, Mr. Gross.
Good morning. May it please the court, Norman Gross, Assistant United States Attorney on behalf of the United States in this case, I ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. I agree with Mr. Sharma that the clear error standard is not toothless. Those teeth are not very long and they're not very sharp. And this court, recently, Judge Montgomery Reeves' opinion in Carabello recited yet again what that standard is. If the district court's finding is plausible in light of the evidence, even if there are other plausible results that the district court could have come to, and even if the judges on this court, sitting as finders of fact, would have reached a different result, this court must affirm.
If I remember that case correctly, it also talks about inferences and the fact that inferences have to be based on some specific evidence. I'm struggling to see the specific evidence here. Can you help me figure out why this is not inferences on top of inferences on top of inferences?
Certainly. And Your Honor, I think inferences on top of inferences are not prohibited as long as each inference is reasonable in light of the evidence. Here,
so does it have to be tied to some evidence at the bottom of all the inferences? So that's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah. Well, there is very strong evidence, in fact, uncontradicted evidence here, that supports the district court's finding. The district court had to find by a preponderance.
Can I stop you there just on that, and then we'll come back to Judge Montgomery Reeves' question? At the hearing, the person who appeared on behalf of the government said that there is no evidence that can support that Mr. Ash had knowledge or control of the AK-47 in the trunk of the car. Now, I realize there's a plea agreement that says, you know, you're not going to put forward that the enhancement necessarily should apply, but to go further and say there is no evidence, that seems to be contradictory to the point you're now making.
Well, a couple of responses to that, Judge Ambrose. First, the plea agreement, as you point out, specifically allows us to oppose the defense appeal and support the district court's findings.
But this is a bad context. I want to get back to her questions, but your point, you said that there was plenty of evidence. That contradicts what the person who appeared on behalf of the government said at the hearing.
It does. And I realize that that could be troubling. But I have to say, candidly, I'm afraid my colleague in the district court was incorrect. And Judge Qureshi pressed her very hard on that point.
Very hard.
And said, here's the evidence. And she said, and this goes to Judge Montgomery Reese's point, there are, as I count it, I believe, seven pieces of evidence that support a finding that Ash, at some point, constructively possessed that gun.
Could you itemize them for us?
I could. Number one, he was the sole owner of the car. There's no dispute about that. He was driving the car immediately before it was impounded. The gun, the Hellpup, was found in the trunk of the car, an area in which the owner and operator would have access. And the police had not searched the trunk before the car was towed to the impoundment lot. And as stated in the PSR and at no point contradicted or objected to by the defense, before the gun was discovered in the trunk, 6.5 months later, it had been stored in a locked impound lot, and the employees of the lot were forbidden to access the car unless they did so to move it or to surrender it to someone who had title. Sixth, Ash possessed another gun inside the car, and he had two prior convictions for unlawful possession of a gun. All of those facts, I submit, point towards and support the district court's finding that Ash constructively possessed this gun. He may not have been the only person who constructively possessed it, but by constructively possessing it, that triggered the enhancement. Now, there were facts that undermine or go against the judge's finding, but the judge had to make a call here. The judge had to find a fact. And reams of case law say that the district court's judge has the primary responsibility and oftentimes the experience to find facts, and here he found a fact that was plausible. And those seven facts, I submit, support it. Now, the judge could also draw on his common sense and his experience, and there are some things in this case that support that as well. The car was found in the trunk. Trunks are normally locked. People don't go around driving cars that don't have locked trunks. Think of your own experience. How often has the trunk of your car not been locked? Impound lots, as a matter of common sense, are going to secure the cars. So Mr. Sharma said, well, it's possible that someone else got in the trunk. It's certainly very unlikely that anybody who is not working at the impound lot got in the trunk because that lot is secured. I had the unfortunate experience of having a car towed to an impound lot in the last year. I can assure you that lot was completely locked, and I had to get access from someone at the lot to let me in to get my effects out of the car. So the judge, just like a jury as fact finder, could draw on his common sense and experience to make those findings that it was quite likely that this gun was in the locked trunk and that the owner of that gun, the owner of that car, put it there. Possible someone else did, but he decided by a bare preponderance, as he was entitled to, that it was more likely than not Ash was the one who put it there. The standard of review here, I think, is dispositive. The judge has very, very substantial, this court owes the district court judge substantial deference in its factual findings. And that's what I'm asking the court to apply here.
Before you get there, don't you have burden on whom does the burden rest? Because a lot of the times in the briefing here, it's statements in effect that Mr. Ash failed to present evidence of another individual who might have had access to the trunk of the car, but the burden's on the government, right?
Absolutely, Judge, but only by a preponderance. The government, and this is an unusual case, as Mr. Sharma said, because we didn't seek this enhancement. We didn't try to prove that Mr. Ash had the gun in the, he was the person who put the gun in the trunk. The plea agreement forbade us from doing so, and well, let me take a step back. There, as I pointed out in our brief, there is a provision in the plea agreement that says that if the government received new information after the signing of the plea agreement that contradicted the stipulations in the plea agreement, the government was not bound by those stipulations. And so the government here would not have violated the plea agreement had it gone into court at the sentencing hearing and said, Judge, there's new information here. This gun was found in the trunk. We didn't know about that when the plea agreement was signed. And we're now asking the court to apply this enhancement. We could have done that under the plea agreement. We chose not to. But in any event, the bottom line is we didn't, it wasn't a question of whether we met the burden. Judge Qureshi understood where the burden was. And even though we weren't advocating for the enhancement, he found that it applied under the preponderance standard.
Were there any fingerprints taken?
I'm sorry?
Were there any fingerprints taken?
No, and of course there's evidence that points to the fact that this wasn't a slam dunk case. You know, were there fingerprints? Were there DNA? And I have to take issue with Mr. Sharma when he said, you know, I think he may have said DNA is often found on recovered guns. That's not my experience. Almost in every one of these 924C cases, we have to put on an expert who testifies, I wasn't able to lift any fingerprints from these guns, but it's very rare. I've seen experts who've been in the business for a long time who said, I've never been able to lift a fingerprint from a gun. So the fact there were no fingerprints, I don't think, really points one way or the other.
So would it make sense to remand this for a more robust evidentiary hearing?
I just don't think that's necessary, Judge Restrepo. But I would say that it certainly would make more sense than simply vacating the judgment and saying that this case has to go back without the enhancement. I think that if you apply the proper standard of review here, this really isn't a very close case, and there's no need for an evidentiary hearing. Judge Montgomery Reeves asked a lot of questions about, you know, what were the circumstances under which the gun was found in the trunk. And those are all, you know, if this were a contested hearing and we were seeking the enhancement, we would have called someone from the tow lot to testify about those circumstances. They might have, you know, they might have nailed down the fact that the trunk was locked and they had to get the gun out of the trunk with the key. They might have also been able to testify, I have no idea whether this is the case or not, there is security cameras in the lot and they looked at security camera video. But we're not, it's just not necessary. And frankly, I think a failure to apply this standard that's come to us for many years from the Supreme Court, Anderson versus City of Bessemer is a case where the Supreme Court reiterated how tough this standard is. And I think if you apply the standard here, based on the facts, you will conclude that this is an affirmance.
Mr. Gross, let me ask you a question. Are you aware, setting aside for a moment the Kennedy case, are you aware of any cases that have these types of timing and chain of custody issues?
I have not seen a case in my research where there was a six-month delay between the seizure of the car and the discovery of the contraband.
And then am I right when I look at Kennedy, and I will admit I had to look back at the briefs in that case to try to piece this together and figure it out, but it seems to me that the car in that context was in the marshal's custody for the entire time. That is, we didn't have the facts that we have here where you have a car that's in police custody and then goes to a third-party lot. Am I correct about that?
You are correct, Your Honor. But the fact that it's in a third-party lot, I would suggest, is not that different from the marshal's custody.
Don't tell the marshal that.
I know.
Judge, just as an aside, I was involved in a case in front of this court a couple of years ago where we seized a boat, and the marshals had custody of it, and it sank. That's United
States. Secure it, though.
So who was driving it?
I'm sorry?
So who was driving it?
The boat was in the marshals actually had turned the boat over to some private marina, and it sank, and it was a total loss. I'm not casting aspersions on the marshals' office. They do a great job. But a private tow lot, an impound lot, is not going to stay in business very long. I mean, there's lots of lots out there. This is something where there's some competition. And if they don't secure those cars and people get into the cars, that's going to hurt business. They have a very strong incentive to secure the cars.
Hypothetically, let's assume this was 2 years later. Same facts, 2 years later, same argument?
If the car has been secured in a lot and all the facts are the same, I would argue, although it's not as strong a case, that yes, we could still, the district court would not have clearly erred by finding.
You assumed a fact. You said if the car was secured. Do you mean just in the lot like it was here, or do you mean something else when you said?
No, I meant in a private impound lot with behind a locked gate and presumably a secure fence. I think that Judge Qureshi would not have been speculating, but would have been applying his common sense and experience by concluding that this car, you could not get to this car unless you worked at that impound lot. And just one other point on the possibility that an employee of the lot might have put the hell pup in the trunk. Consider this. I mean, that person puts the gun in the trunk. He has no control over it at that point. At any point, the car may be released to the person who has an interest in the car, who owns the car, and then the gun is gone. And this is a valuable gun, as we pointed out in our brief. These things cost about $700, and it's hard to get a hold of them in New Jersey, which is very strict gun law. So if you were someone who illegally possessed one of these guns, you worked at the impound lot, I dare say sticking the gun in the trunk of a car stored in that impound lot is not a very good idea. And that's just aside from the fact that there's lots of cars in that lot to choose from. How did it happen to just end up in this car belonging to this defendant? Judge Qureshi found that was unlikely.
When the car was first impounded, why was there not an inspection done of what were the car's contents?
There is no evidence about why the law enforcement officials didn't search the entire car, and so I can't answer that question. It was, in retrospect.
I mean, if that had happened, we might not be here today.
Exactly. But isn't it nice that we are?
Touché.
Unless the court has any other questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I think it's very telling that the government says the preponderance standard is not toothless, but those teeth aren't sharp. I think that if this court affirms here, it is, in my view, sub silentio overruling Chicharello. Chicharello said that where the evidence was in equipoise, that the preponderance standard had been violated and it was clear error in that case. And here, I just want to say about the plausibility standard put forth by the government, I think that plausibility standard has to be read in context. I don't think it's an, Iqbal Twombly style plausibility standard. Obviously, if something is found in the trunk of my car, is it plausible that it's mine? Of course it is. The issue here is that there was no corroborating evidence. And the clear error standard, as the government recognizes in its brief, is that even where there is some evidence supporting a supporting a finding. The entire body of evidence leaves the court with the firm conviction that an error has been made. And here, this court should have the firm conviction that the preponderance standard was violated, in our view. And I do want to say that if this court sub silentio overrules Chicharello, I do think it will insulate district courts from review. I think they will absolutely adopt the view that the preponderance standard might not be toothless, but those teeth aren't very sharp. As for the argument that tow yards must be secure, otherwise they wouldn't stay in business, I don't really know how to answer that. I don't think that's necessarily correct. Once again, we don't know what sort of security procedures this place had, how many employees it had, et cetera. As for remand for an evidentiary hearing, the government suggests that that might be a great idea here, if this court doesn't affirm. Once again, the government had the burden of production and persuasion. Under Dickler, there should not be a remand for an evidentiary hearing.
Let me ask you, you keep saying in your opening and now that if we were to affirm the enhancement here, it would be overruling Chicharello. Aren't the facts there? What are the facts there that are on point? And isn't that case distinguishable?
Well, Your Honor, okay, so in Chicharello, may I continue? Okay. So in Chicharello, the defendant was convicted of disposing of 22 firearms, okay? And three of those firearms were later found to have been used in felonies. And the district court said, well, where there's smoke, there's fire. Three of these were found later in committing felonies. He must have sold them with the reason to believe that they would be used in felonies. And this court said, well, we don't have information about how he sold them. For all we know, he could have sold them to a pawn shop or to a certified gun dealer, and they sold it to these people with felonies, or who went on to commit felonies. And so, yes, and so the court said the evidence is at least in equipoise. We are left with the firm conviction that the preponderance standard has been violated. Is that case distinguishable? I think every case that's fact-specific is somehow distinguishable. I think Irvin is very distinguishable, which the government cites as its best case for affirming here. I do believe that here the evidence is at least in equipoise that we don't know, as the government recognized below, we don't know who had access to the car, both ex ante and ex post. We know that he possessed the car at the time of arrest. We don't know whether he had any associates, whether they borrowed the car. Yes, it was solely registered to him, but people borrow cars. And frankly, let's be honest, sometimes people engaged in criminal activity have friends who are engaged in criminal activity. And so for all we know, one of his friends could have put it in there. Does that excuse the behavior? No. But does it go to whether he's punishable for this enhancement? Yes. We believe that the evidence is at least in equipoise that he had knowledge of this gun ex ante, and we believe that ex post, given the lack of evidence, reliable, specific evidence that the tow yard was secure, that there's serious problems here on all fronts. I believe that this case, this unusual case is a great opportunity for this court to reaffirm the lack of toothlessness of the preponderance standard and to ensure the integrity of the sentencing process. Just because Mr. Ash may have committed one crime, that doesn't mean that he should just get this enhancement because of a bunch of assumptions that the district court made. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Well, thank counsel for their arguments and